Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You're listening to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you in-depth and behind the scenes with the biggest stars and creators on Broadway and at this year's Tony Awards. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to actor Andrew Garfield, who's currently up for Best Actor in a Play for his performances as Prior Walter in the Broadway revival of the epic 7.5-hour two-parter, Angels in America. Garfield, whose varied film career includes The Social Network, The Amazing Spider-Man, Mel Gibson's Hacksaw Ridge, and Martin Scorsese's Silence, is appearing on Broadway for the second time following his Tony-nominated turn as Biff in Mike Nichols' 2012 revival of Death of a Salesman. He's in the studio with me to tell us about his work on the show, the experience of being a Tony nominee, and what's next for him on stage and on screen. Hey, Andrew. Thanks for being here.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great.
I'm happy to be here. It's nice to talk with you always. So
yeah, nice to see you. Congratulations on your Tony nomination.
Oh my God, thank you so much.
And on all the show's nominations. It's the most nominated show and play in Broadway history.
Yeah, that was something. I didn't expect that. I didn't expect, you know, I think I tend to go through life thinking I'm cooler than I am. And I confess I woke up early to see what was getting nominated and what and I didn't think I would care, but I really cared. It was a really sweet morning, and I thought I was really overwhelmed by it, especially maybe mostly because of Susan Brown being nominated, because you know, she's so remarkable and she really didn't expect it, and even though some of us did, it was I started dancing. That's when I started dancing horizontally in bed.
Yeah. Susan Brown plays Joe Pitt's mother, whose name I forget.
Hannah Pitt.
Hannah. And I was she also say Helen, yes.
Yeah, Hannah Pitt. She also plays Ethel Rosenberg.
Yeah,
she plays
definitely
a rabbi.
Oh, the rabbi in the beginning,
she
yeah.
She plays
of
the oldest living Bolshevik.
Yeah.
She plays
You got off pretty easy with just the one part, really.
Yeah, I know. I have this is the easiest job I'll ever do. Yeah. I play Man in the Park as well.
Oh, okay.
That's me,
true.
Gordon. That's
yeah, well,
me.
That's the magic.
Believe it or not, that's the chameleonic actor that I am. You didn't even know it was me that was fucking Lewis up the ass in the park. So that's I say to everyone, like, God, I just wish I would love to just do a play that just if I was just playing Man in the Park, this would be a very different experience. Just one scene a day.
Yeah, in and out.
In and out, so to speak.
Exactly. And you just came from the Tony Nominees Luncheon, is an annual Tony's event that's just for the nominees. There's no press invited or anybody else. It's just for the nominated actors and designers and directors and everyone. Mm-hmm. What was that event like?
Well, I just came from it, and it was actually very, very sweet. It was very sweet in the real sense of the word, not in a patronizing way. It was very, you know, like sweet fruit. Mm-hmm. And it was a real celebration of, you know, all of the, I think you forget how lucky you are that you get to do what you do. And you also forget how surreal it is and how outrageous it is that you are in this kind of rarefied place where you get to not only do what you do, but have it seen in such a kind of mass way on Broadway. I just get struck with gratitude for having that kind of platform to tell this story, particularly with these incredible artists. And then you get into a room with a bunch of other incredible artists who are making their own stories and are changing people's lives all over this town. It's a really, and you know, obviously I do believe that. I do believe that story is maybe the best medicine, homeopathic cure for our whatever, you know, emotional, psychological, human ailment we're suffering from in any given moment. The stories reveal to us where we are, who we are, and where to go next. Right. Partly, anyway. So today was a really sweet celebration of, in the entertainment industry, in Broadway and Hollywood, you know, that we can be accused of a bit of, you know, self-congratulatory behavior. I do really acknowledge that. And in the same breath, we need it because we're all so damn needy, and we're all, it is. I can say this about other people. I find it courageous. People who perform, people who make art. I think it's a courageous act. I think it's really scary and very dangerous, especially in the times we're in politically, socially, where if you stick your head above the parapet in any way, shape, or form, you're going to get your head chopped off by at least 1,000 people. So I was really moved being in the room, and I got to sit next to Cyndi Lauper.
And you got to sit next to Cyndi Lauper.
and I said to her, and the first thing I said to her was, "I'm so sorry, but I'm a huge fan ever since The Goonies." And she said, and she her response was so beautiful. She was like, "Oh, you're a Goonie," and I was like, "Yeah, I'm a Goonie to my bone marrow." And she was very, very sweet, and she's so charming, and she had to kind of announce a bunch of the nominees, and she got most people's names wrong, and still managed to make that adorable and charming and totally. She's just one of those people that's just totally herself. So I think we should all aspire to be more like Cyndi.
This is your second time through the nominations process.
Mm-hmm.
How does it compare to something like the Oscars, which you were nominated for last year for Hacksaw Ridge?
I find that a very interesting question, which I unexpectedly, you know, I find that an unexpectedly interesting question because, you know, but so with the Oscars, the performance is done, the film's done, it's out there.
Yeah, it's in the can, right?
Now all there is to try and convince people that it's good, right. And, you know, and try and convince people that it's, you know, that it's worthy and that it deserves its place in the sun. You know, when for the Tonys, what I'm realizing now is that you keep having to prove that it's good because you're on stage every night still doing it. Well, for the shows that are still running anyway.
Right.
So like we are going out to these events and, you know, having these wonderful, you know, connections and meetings and saying hello to people.
Yeah, we should say there's a whole slew of theater community events.
Yeah.
There are other award shows. There are like these, you know, nominees events and all sorts of things.
That, yeah. And it's, it is kind of like being on a campaign of some sort. But on the surface, it's a celebration. I think, and maybe in the deepest sense, it is a celebration and a gratitude ritual. It's a way of expressing. You know, I love that idea that actually these awards things are a gratitude ritual where we get to express gratitude for, you know, the tremendously fortunate positions we're in. Mm. But the main difference is that we are performing every night. All the shows that are still on, that are still running, are having to sing for their supper. And, you know, I hear, you know, Tony voters come in this particular period, and it's like, wow, what a weird thing where, you know, you've gotten this honor anyway of a nomination. Mm. But then there's that you kind of have to prove that it was the right choice. What a weird and kind of, you know, I don't know. I think it makes me quite neurotic. I think it makes most people kind of neurotic, but I think the trick is the beautiful thing. You just do your work. You just show up and do your work, and then the great thing. It's a great opportunity to go to these very schmancy events where you get to sit next to Cyndi Lauper and be yourself. Practice being yourself. That in my favorite musical of last year, Dear Evan Hansen, that was, you know, the perfect message. For a generation who are being fed constantly who to be and how to be, and it's usually anything but who they actually are and their unique being. So I get to go to these events and practice what Evan Hansen learned. that's my task right now.
You really like theater work. You really love doing it. Tell us about your commitment to it, what you get out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it feeds me more than any other acting I've done. It feels like where I'm meant to be. I found my little piece of the garden to tend to keep the world spinning forward in my own little way. So in that respect, I don't know if I could explain why. It's like that feeling when you come home. It's that feeling when you you cross. I recently bought a home, my first home, back home in London, and I looked for a year, and then I walked across the threshold of this place, and something chemical happened, something very cosmic and internal shifted. And I thought, oh, there was no thought, it was a knowing. And I there was a voice that said, this is it. And I have the same feeling with theater. I have the same feeling when I get to be on stage, and you know, especially and really only when it's a piece of work that is speaking to me at this very moment, and I feel speaking to the world, the universe, at this very moment. So there, it has to be a real kind of kismet feeling. And of course, with Angels in America right now, there's no better time to be telling this story, strangely enough.
Yeah.
And with Death of a Salesman back 4 years ago, it felt well, there's never ever a bad time for that play. And
you could say the same about Angels.
But I think especially with a Republican government, and especially with a government that seemingly has no ethical or center of decency, with the current regime that we have in power, I think it's the perfect indictment. You just kind of replace Reagan with Trump, and it's the same. It's the same problems, but maybe magnified, to be honest, now.
Right. Of course, your relationship with a theater audience is very different from your relationship with the people who see your movies, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, for one thing, they're right there with you, living through the story, right?
Yeah.
You enjoy that connection with
them. Oh, I do. Like. Well, it's a funny thing. It's an interesting thing as well. I have different relationships with different people based on what movies they've seen.
Mm.
And what plays they've seen. So the easiest one to describe is, you know, the people who really have just seen Spider-Man, and there's not really occasionally I'll have a really lovely connection with someone, but mostly it's like, can I get a picture? And I don't, it's like seeing an animal in the wild or Mickey Mouse or something. And then, you know, those kind of exchanges are very brief and quite superficial. And then there's people who have seen, there's people who are really into this one short SNL short I did when I hosted SNL.
Uh-huh.
This wing sketch that I did with Dave McCrary and Kyle Mooney and Beck Bennett. That has a little cult thing. So some people will talk to me about that, and then other people, you know, will talk to me about the other films. But then my relationship with people after the show. At stage door, it feels like a much more level playing field. It feels like we've just done something together. It feels like we've created something together, and there's a much more intimacy. And I think because there's no screen in between, it is a flesh and blood. They thankfully perceive me as not unlike them, which is the truth, of course, and makes me very happy. I believe makes them very happy, and then it's less transactional, and it's much more soulful.
Yeah. Angels is such a specific story in terms of where it is located and what it is about. You know, it's set in New York in 1985, 1986, you know, as the AIDS epidemic was kind of ravaging the gay and the artistic communities of the city. I imagine it can feel somewhat removed from, you know, someone who spends most of his time in London. And, you know, what did you find was easy for you to get about the character and the story?
I don't know about easy. I think, well, there's thankfully, you know, all of the research that you need is there. There's plenty of amazing
What kind of things?
Literature and, well, you know, what's that great comprehensive book? And The Band Played On.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm. That's obviously a great starting point. Right. And then, you know, queer culture and gay culture. I mean, that's a lifetime's work right there, and kind of, it's like the most beautiful research I've ever done. You know, there's a couple of things. I think I mentioned this to you back when we talked a while ago.
Yes, is the documentary that
Common
you mentioned?
Threads. There's a few things.
About the AIDS quilt.
About the AIDS quilt, and it's got everything in it. Another film that I really love is The Celluloid Closet.
Yeah.
You know, that's a very comprehensive history of you know gay cinema and the homosexual experience in cinema. You know, and then, you know, say groundbreaking things like the Boys in the Band and, you know, Longtime Companion. You know, I love all culture, and I especially love gay culture and queer culture. And there's just so much inspiration to draw. And then, you know, that period of the 80s and the terrible circumstances, the unimaginable circumstances that the community was going through, the loss of life at such a rate, and the lack of support and care from the government, from the Republican administration, the unimaginable strength and self-worth and dignity that must have been called upon within each person, each beautiful man going through such indignity of having your body shut down on you and then having certain parts of society, specifically, you know, religious society, saying this is what you get for being born wrong. The knowing, the ability to fight a world telling you falsely that you were made incorrectly, that perhaps is the most unimaginable thing, and somehow the most imaginable thing for me to slip into. And my great privilege in playing this part, maybe the greatest privilege of playing this part, is honoring that strength and ability to say no to people and to say yes to yourself, to say yes to your own life, to say yes to your own self-validation, and to say no to a torrent of abuse and indignity and ignorant, foolish, narrow-minded hate. That, I think, is the thing that I find most inspiring and that I bow deeply to, I bow deepest to.
Do you find that the story, as we were saying a little earlier, is not only particularly American, but it's very New York. It's very set in New York. Do you, after doing the show in London, do you find that there are moments that land differently or the audience responds in a different way here?
Koch.
Yeah. They know who he is, yeah.
I mean, it's the biggest laugh of the day.
Yeah.
And in London, it was like three people
slapping
their thigh and like the other 800 kind of, eh? You know, so that's like the most superficial response is, you know, you guys get it all. Right. You guys get it all. Even the stuff that we didn't get when we first read it.
Right.
And, you know, there's also Angels in America superfans. Mm-hmm. There are those guys that have been in the theater watching since Steven Spinella and Marsha Gay Harden and, you know, George Wolfe directly.
Jeffrey Wright.
So they're clapping before a line's been said.
Right.
Because it's their favorite line, which is delightful and slightly kind of, you know, a little discombobulating. But but it's beautiful. It's like, you know, Harry Potter have all their wizard fans and we have, you know, the gay community here in the city of you know, the men who lived through the time, the men who sat by the bedsides of their lost lovers, or the men who survived it, the men who survived the plague. And, you know, Peter Staley is, you know, a hero of mine, and I got to meet him at opening night. You know, for people who don't know who that is, he was one of the great pioneers of the ACT UP movement, and he is just this beautiful soul who became a full-time activist. I think he was a lawyer. He was a stockbroker. He was like he was on the stock exchange. He was like one of those guys, super masculine kind of. And then he got the virus and he dedicated himself to activism. And if it wasn't for people like him, you know, nothing would have got done. He sacrificed himself. He sacrificed his, you know, because he loved life and because he knew that he deserved to live it. He knew that others, all of his brothers, deserved to live it. So, you know, when people like him are in the crowd, you get filled up. I had a friend in on Saturday who was a beautiful man from Portland, Oregon, who lived through the crisis here in New York, and he lost a lot of friends. And he texted me ahead of time saying, "Look, give me a wide berth. I may not come and see you afterwards because I may just have to go and, you know, grieve, carry on the grieving process that has been going on for 25, 30 years." And I said, "Of course." But he did come back, and, you know, but he texted me saying, "I'm going to have to bring in some souls with me today. I'm gonna, there's going to be a bunch of people in there with me that are going to be invisible, but they're there." And I said, "Bring them in, and we're gonna do our best to do some healing for them and for you and for all of us." It is that profound. It can be that profound. I do feel that, especially in the epilogue at the end. You know, it's I'm not just speaking to the people in the audience. I'm speaking to all the souls that brought in, and, you know, I can feel it. Some on nights where the channel's open, I can feel it, and it's the great privilege of my life as an artist so far.
You mentioned Harry Potter earlier, another two-part play. Have you had talks with them about what it's like to do a two-part show?
Well, it's funny. It's funny because, like, you know, I mean, by the way, theirs is, I think, 4.5 hours all told.
Yeah,
five hours.
Come on, they get off easy.
Yeah, let's be real. But saying that, you know, they're doing one extra show a week than us, and they are, I think, their run is much longer. So it all balances out in the end. And their play is about wizards, and our play is about AIDS. So let's be honest about that. No, but, you know, wizards have a hard time, they go through it. I haven't seen it. I'm so excited to see it. Every one of my friends is like so angry at me for not being able to talk to them about it yet. And I hear it's just this phenomenon. And it's been so nice to be able to hang out with Jamie and Anthony on this Anoma, on this circuit. It's been this amazing kind of...
Those are the Tony-nominated actors from Harry Potter, by the way.
The British invasion of Broadway. So, British and Irish. It's been a really fun time to share with them.
Yeah. So you're in Angels through July 15th. And then what's next for you after that?
How dare you? You expect me to do anything after this? I don't know, have any idea. I feel satiated artistically, like, you know, maybe slightly too, so maybe a bit filled up. Maybe I'm a little fat with it. You know, it's one of those things you can see. It doesn't get better, doesn't get richer, it doesn't get more profound as far as telling a story. So I'm a little bit at a loss. It's also because I'm tired and I can't really imagine going to work ever again. It's a weird thing as an actor. I always threaten this. I'm always like, I'm going to retire. This is it. I can't imagine ever. But I really don't know, but I'm excited to listen, to take a minute, be with friends, be with family and just listen and, let my instinct find its way. And I think that's I'm in a very privileged position where I get to do that, where I get to, you know, I've created that for myself for sure. You know, I'm not absconding myself of total responsibility. Like I've wanted this in my life, and I created it for myself. I could have taken things out of fear. I could have made certain choices in a fearful way, and then been kind of a slave to fear, I suppose. And I work really hard to not do that. I work really hard to be driven by something deeper than that. So I say it's a privilege, and I also have to acknowledge that we get to create that if we, first of all, if we have the opportunity to, which I did. Right. And then if we want it enough, I think I like the idea that we can all do that. I like the idea that we can all choose our destiny, that we can all listen closely enough and sacrifice enough to then for the right thing to come in and for our life to be what it's meant to be. I do believe that. If I didn't believe that, I wouldn't want to be a part of a universe that didn't include that as its ethos. I really do, and I hope that doesn't come off kind of glib or naive, because I know that I was born with a certain amount of privilege that allowed me to make those choices, make those decisions. I was by no means born into a household that had lots of money, but I am white and I am straight, and I know that those basic, and I'm male, and I know that those basic things that I was born into give me a certain advantage in a culture that is slowly working itself out to be fair and balanced, far too slowly. But anyway, that's my wish for every human being is that we, because I do think we all have something specific to do here. We all have a little part of the garden to tend to. I do believe that. So that's my hope and dream. And you know, in when I say more life at the end of the play, the great work begins. There's a part of me that is saying to every single person, like, you have to go and do exactly what you're meant to do. Otherwise, we're not gonna get him out of the office. We're not gonna, otherwise evil will triumph.
But so what do you feel like is going to be the project that gets you back to the theater? Do you have any sense of what would be the thing that would bring you back?
I don't know. I mean, it's a funny thing since, because when I first left drama school, I did theater and theater and theater and theater. And the last play I did in London was at the National Theater, which was a trilogy of plays, one by Ender Walsh, one by Mark Ravenhill, and then another play by J.T. Rogers called The Overwhelming, which is about the Rwandan genocide. Yeah. And so that was the last, and then I started doing films. And the next theater experience I had was with Mike Nichols doing Death of a Salesman, with Philip Seymour Hoffman, Linda Emond, and Finn Wittrock. And it really was, when a theater opportunity comes along, it has to like feel like a lightning bolt just hit the bottom of my soul, and there has to be no choice, because I know what it costs. Doing theater is costly for actors. It's punishing, it's grueling, and equally rewarding. So therefore, I can't go to work unless it's unless I know it's an unequivocal yes, a fuck yes, as it were. So I don't know what that would be, but I'm excited. I had an idea that I would take off the summer and just read plays, just kind of send like message to my dramaturg friends and say, just send me a bunch of things like ideas of stuff that you think I'd just like to read, and because I love reading plays even more than I love reading books, to be honest.
Well, I can't wait to see what gets you back.
It
was great talking to you. Thanks
too.
For being here.
Thanks,
Andrew.
Gordon. Thank you, really.
That was Andrew Garfield, the Oscar-nominated film star who's now nominated for a Tony Award for his performance in Angels in America, now playing through July 15th at the Neil Simon Theater. On the next episode of Stagecraft, I'll be talking to Jesse Mueller and Joshua Henry, the two Tony-nominated stars of Carousel. Until then, see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the SUPs. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Suf's celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suf's has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.